First-hand accounts of the Holocaust are being told by fewer and fewer people each year, and in an age of disinformation, the need to preserve their stories is critical. What if you could speak directly with a Holocaust survivor, even if they were no longer with us? How would it grow your understanding of history, and would it raise any ethical questions? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The Nancy and David Wolf Holocaust and Humanity Center in Cincinnati is bringing these stories to life, including the stories of local survivors. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about how that's happening are Holocaust survivor and retired physics professor Henry Fenichel, Barbara Miller, the daughter-in-law of Holocaust survivor Al Miller, and Nancy and David Wolf Holocaust and Humanity Center CEO Jackie Conjato. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Henry, I want to start with you. You were born in the Netherlands. How old were you when the German army occupied Holland?
I was born in 1938. The Nazis came in, invaded Holland in 1940. For 1 year, they didn't do much of anything. They just slowly took over. The cop on the street corner became Nazi, and they started with the traffic. Eventually, they started to round up Jews, at which point my father was taken, captured, and taken away and never to return from Auschwitz. They started by rounding up men. And even that might be considered reasonable. There's a war going on and the soldiers need help. And so you take the enemy manpower and use it. That's the point at which the Jewish men were rounded up, supposedly to go to work in labor camps. And, of course, never came back. Then a year later, they started to round up not just men, but women, children, babies, grandparents. If you weren't suspicious before, at that point, you need those in labor camp. That's the point at which I was the only child, and my mother and I went into hiding into a child care center in The Hague. I was born in The Hague, and I lived in The Hague.
And what happened to you and your mother after that?
So we were in hiding for less than a year. At some point, they discovered us. How did they discover us? I'm still trying to find out the details. I mean, could have been very, as a kid, you know, playing in the yard, they may have discovered. Anyway, rounded up for a while. We were held in Amsterdam, and then eventually we were taken to a camp called Westerbork. That was a transit camp on the border of Holland, the Netherlands, and Germany. Jews were rounded up, were put in that camp. And from that camp, periodically, typically they had actually a schedule. Every Tuesday morning, they rounded up on the order of 1,000 people, 900 to 1,200, on a train station, loaded them up on cattle cars. Most of them never came back. So we were there again less than a year, but in February 1944, we were put on that train and ended up in the German concentration camp called Bergen-Belsen. When people ask me, what's your background? I said, are you familiar with the story of Anne Frank, the Diary of Anne Frank? Very similar, captured, hiding, except I survived Bergen-Belsen where she perished. Mm.
Do you remember much about the camp you survived? You must have been very young.
No, I was very young, and I don't remember that much. There are a few things I remember. I remember that every day, every morning, they had roll call, and we were given our food, and each one of us had a small little round can or dish, if you wish, and there was this big pail on the ground, something that looked like a big garbage pail full of some slop they called soup, and we had that and some black bread, and I remember having that as food. After the meal, so to speak, they had us, the few children who were there, to clean those barrels up. In retrospect, I think they did it probably so maybe we can find another few potato peels for extra nourishment. The other thing I remember about the meal and the food is that this black bread we have, every day, my mother would have to tell me, we'd take a little piece of that bread, put it aside, so that on Friday night, we would have that as our Jewish celebration of the Sabbath, and that would be our challah.
You're 86 now. Why was it important for you to have your memories and your very rich story of survival preserved in the way that the Holocaust and Humanity Center is preserving it?
While I was in Cincinnati, I had a good job working at the University of Cincinnati for about 40 years, and I was busy professionally and pretty happy, didn't worry much and think about the past. Once I retired, they stopped paying me, and the center was developed. I was involved with survivors here and there beforehand. We would get socially, and we did a lot of communications, what I would say is in silence. We knew what the subject was. But eventually, as the center grew out of that, I became involved. And once I retired, I have the time to do it. So I myself, every day, I really think, why did I survive? I mean, there's so many people in my family died. And maybe the reason is to bear witness to what happens. And that's what I'm doing now, going around. The center sends me to high schools or to local so at least about once a week or every other week I give a presentation.
Jackie, the Holocaust and Humanity Center has had this Dimensions in Testimony exhibit for several years where people can have conversations with these holographic images of survivors, but this expansion has local survivors. Tell us about that and why the center felt it was so important to have these local stories represented.
Thank you for asking. The beauty of what has been built at Union Terminal is that this history that can often be seen as a very global history, something that happened far away, and is told through the lens of the local people who survived it. People like Henry, people like Barb's father-in-law, Al, who lived through the unthinkable, came to Cincinnati, rebuilt their lives, became professors at the University of Cincinnati, became, you know, other neighbors and teachers and folks in our community. And so it's what makes our museum so personal. It's what makes for an incredibly meaningful experience for visitors and very relevant and human. But up until just this month, we have never had local testimony in this gallery, this Dimensions and Testimony Gallery, which is our most interactive space. It's where you can, as you said, come in and have a real conversation in real time with a two-dimensional video image of a survivor. And these are real videos that we've captured with an algorithm that pairs questions with the answers that have been recorded. And so it's been amazingly special to have now local stories in that space as well, because kids will come in, and these are digital natives. These are kids who are used to learning on screens and through tablets and online, and so they take to it immediately, and they want to know all kinds of things. You know, they want to know about what happened during the war. They also want to know what their favorite color is. You wouldn't believe how many people come through, and they say, back before we had the local testimonies, they would ask, when did you come to Cincinnati? And the survivor would say, I never have been there. I'm in, you know, the UK or in another state. And so it's special to be able to, for people to say, wow, this is someone I could run into on the street. Even questions that are local.
We're talking in this recorded interview about an expanded exhibit at the Nancy and David Wolfe Holocaust and Humanity Center that allows you to have conversations with Holocaust survivors. Barbara, your father-in-law is one of the local survivors who shared his memories and his story as part of this exhibit. As I understand it, he died a few months after doing that. Is that right?
Yes, he perished 6 months after doing his story. And it was quite amazing because he was almost 101, and he was 100 at the time of the interview. And the interview process was intense. It's 5 days a week, about 6 hours of questions. Sometimes the same question is asked over and over and in different ways to ensure that how people might ask a similar question differently. And he had to wear the same outfit, you know, make sure nothing spilled on it from day to day. And at 100, we would get him ready for the day early in the morning, drive down to the studio. He'd spend that day there. And it was really quite remarkable. And honestly, his memory was phenomenal. And we learned a lot as family members. You know, it was a real experience for us and my husband and my brothers-in-laws and my sister-in-law to, you know, sit there and listen to him and get to hear our entire family history And now it's quite remarkable that my grandsons, who are 5 and 18 months old right now, one day will stand in front of their grandfather and have a conversation with him. And I often think about all the times that I wish I could have asked my own parents questions, and still do. You know, God, if I'd only asked them this, that, and the other thing. So it's quite remarkable that we have this treasure, and I'm very grateful.
Can you tell us just a little bit about your father-in-law's story?
Sure. My father-in-law was born in 1922 in Berlin. His family had been rooted in Berlin and Germany for several generations. They owned a textile shirt factory in Berlin. The mayor of Berlin celebrated the 50th anniversary of this factory in the year about 1921. My father-in-law lived a very wonderful childhood until Hitler came to power. And as my father-in-law always said, in many ways, they were the lucky ones, but it wasn't just luck. It was courage. It was determination. They were able to eventually escape Nazi Germany. My father-in-law was the last child in his classroom. He experienced friends who turned on him. He experienced teachers who belittled him. And my father-in-law learned quickly that words really matter. And he always said that the Holocaust did not start with bullets. It started with words, and words affected him. Long story short, he and his entire family managed to escape. They come to America. My father-in-law always got very emotional when he thought about his first sight of the Statue of Liberty and what it meant to come to America and what freedom meant and what it meant to be a refugee and what it meant to know that this was a place where he had opportunity and his family did. And as soon as my father-in-law was able to, he enlisted in the U.S. Army. He served as a Ritchie boy. He was sent back to Germany to interrogate Nazi war criminals. And he wanted to express his gratitude and give back to his new country. And so I think my father-in-law's story is one that really resonates in today's time and how important America has always been to refugees and to immigrants and the freedom and opportunity it provides.
Jackie, what are some of the ethical questions that you've examined as part of doing this work? I mean, how important is consent and really broad explanation of how this is going to be used from the people who participate in this whole thing?
Yeah, so it's essential. And we have tremendous partners at the USC Shoah Foundation who pioneered this technology, who have implemented it, you know, many times over with different testimonies. We are very careful to make sure that obviously, you know, the folks we're interviewing are fully consenting to share their stories in this way. The other, you know, question in an environment of misinformation is this question of AI and how AI plays into this. And I always share for people when I talk about this technology that it is not an AI image that you're looking at. These are real videos of real people who have really answered these questions in the way that you're hearing them. There is a piece that actually powers the way the questions solicit the answers, right? And so, you know, there's an AI algorithm that's adaptive to understand if you ask a question, what are you trying to get at in terms of an answer, and how do we best source that answer that is real? But when we think about the work of Holocaust education in today's day and age with growing Holocaust denial and trivialization, it's so important that we underscore these firsthand experiences. These are real, authentic accounts from people who lived this history. And so it's like any technology, right? There's pluses and minuses to it. But I think that this Dimensions and Testimony is an amazing, really transformative way that is going to change the way people learn about this history for generations to come and preserve the opportunity to have real conversations in real time.
Henry, did you have any qualms about participating in this?
No, not at all. Just as Jackie just mentioned, you know, the reason is to educate the people and to bear witness. You know, you have so many people who deny the Holocaust, and how do you deal with it? I mean, in fact, when I give a presentation, frequently the question is, what do you tell to people who deny the Holocaust? My answer is, when they deny the Holocaust, their heroes, the Nazis, are turning in their graves. They were proud of what they were doing. They kept records. And when I started to speak about this, as a scientist, I needed to have data, right? So I went back to Holland, to Germany, and tried to collect any documents about what has happened to me. And the records are unbelievable. I was just a little child between the ages of 4 and 6 during this period. And I found a document which covers me, where we lived, the house, the apartment we lived in The Hague, when we were captured, where we were, when we were in Westerbork, when we were in Bergen-Belsen, and how I survived. And they have all of this written down. You know, they were proud of what they were doing. The Nazis were going to get rid of the riffraff, the Jews and what have you, and they kept records. And I found records from my father, the date he arrived in Auschwitz and the date they killed him. Unreal.
Barbara, what about your father-in-law?
He did not express any concerns. I think he felt very privileged to be able to do this. He had been speaking to many students in schools. He had really influenced so many people had heard him already. And I think that he really wanted his story documented. I also think he recognized the importance that a student, a young person in particular, can bring themselves to this experience, right? They can come and they can ask the questions that interest them. And I think that this is the opportunity of speaking with real people who went through history. This is not just something that happened long ago. These are the people who experienced. There's nothing like that. And I think he recognized that. And I have to say that our family often sat around the breakfast table or the dinner table hearing many of the conversations and the things that he shared. And it was really so fascinating to see the documents and the things that my father-in-law was able to bring out with them. And now that this is in the archives at our museum, but really it was quite remarkable to have not only his story, but the things that actually backed it up. Now having that placed in a museum allows for that experience as well.
Henry, Barbara mentioned that now her father-in-law will be able to answer questions of his grandchildren, of his great-grandchildren for generations to come. And I think many of us would give anything to be able to have a conversation with a loved one who's not with us anymore. The children and grandchildren and nieces and nephews in your life will be able to do that. Is there anything you wish you could ask your father?
I hardly know my father, and my memories are relatively limited. Remember, it was at the age of 4 that he was taken away. But I specifically, I guess as a child, remember him taking me to the zoo in The Hague. And the zoo in The Hague is similar to the zoo in Cincinnati. And they have a little island, pond and an island, a monkey island, you know, where the monkeys run around. And I remember him taking me there and watching the monkeys. Periodically, I go to the local zoo to do the same. I go to the zoo and I go to the monkey island and have a conversation with the monkeys.
Yeah, you feel close to your dad.
So that brings me to a memory and a connection of what I might have had with my father. Beyond that, you know, it was a man busy working and so forth, so my contact limited. The other thing about him is he apparently was an outstanding piano player. And my mother would say he would, in the evening, would come back from work. The first thing he does is sits down at the piano and plays for a while, and he was apparently outstanding in that business. Mm. Which sometime I thought, you know, I should learn how to play the piano too, which I have yet to do.
There's still time, right?
Right.
Jackie, what do you hope people walk away with?
I mean, you hear it in the stories that Henry and Barb are sharing. It's so important for people to understand that humanity is so fragile. There is a fragility in how all of this disappears quickly. You know, we can all look back in hindsight and say that was awful. How could that have happened? We need to ask ourselves, how are the small choices that we're making every day bending humanity towards its better or worse nature? That is the question for all of us every day that we're awake and walking around in this world right now. I hope people come and they get their questions answered, and they feel connected to these stories, and they feel a personal urgency to make choices and act in a way that bends us towards a brighter future and doesn't return us to the darkness that we've come from. It's in small choices and small moments that these things happen. It's words, right? And so it's on all of us. I hope people feel connected and empowered to make a difference in a way that's going to be good for our world and our community.
Well, I've been talking with Holocaust survivor and retired physics professor Henry Fenichel, Barbara Miller, the daughter-in-law of Holocaust survivor Al Miller, and Nancy and David Wolf, Holocaust and Humanities Center CEO Jackie Conjado. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us, Lucy.
The Holocaust and Humanities Center is offering free general admission throughout the month of January. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.